This is The Disposable Web. It is the sequel to the Social Business Hangout, and this is the first episode. With me today is
Martin Buckland from Elite Resumes.
Now, Martin, you and I have known each other on and off for maybe about 6 years, give or take.
Something like that. Something Yeah.
But this is the first time in a very long time that you and I have actually been sitting face-to-face in real life. And we're doing it at a very unique location. We're doing it at the Bell Homestead. Now, we are in Brantford, Ontario. We are at the Bell Homestead, where the telephone got invented, thought of, imagined. You just had a tour of the facility. I'd like to get your thoughts on that before we get into the interview.
Yeah, it was quite an eye-opener. The actual facility is obviously very historic, very beautifully maintained and restored. A lot of thought has gone into it. A lot of research has gone into bringing it back to its original over when the Bells used to live here. So it was very, very informative, very exciting to just take a trip through this beautiful house.
You are very much impacted by communication. It's a core of what you do. Obviously, there was communication outside of the telephone, but a lot of what we do now in business is telephone related. Your thoughts on communication, telephone, given the location that we're in right now?
Well, I actually live virtually. I live way up above Barrie in Ontario, so but I have a global clientele. So using the telephone and other mediums that are available today is very, very important to me. And so communications, I'm very strong on communications, both teaching it to my clients to teach them how to communicate effectively. My clients are the senior executives of corporate Canada, senior executives of the corporate US. So it's very important for them to use communications to the maximum.
One of the things that came up actually in the conversation was an executive conversation about where Bell would put their headquarters, because even though the telephone was basically created in Brantford, they opted to put it in Montreal. And one of the things that I find is, and this is a conversation I've had with other people, is an environment, a city, is quite often defined by its industry. And a lot of CEOs quite often decide where they want to live and thus build the business there.
Exactly.
So you do a lot of work in the Toronto market space.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Your thoughts on something that we talked about just moments ago about being an executive in a corporate jungle, and we've been talking a bit about the corporate retreat. I just want to maybe get your thoughts on that.
Well, yes, I mean, Bell obviously took the decision to move to Montreal. Obviously, Toronto wasn't the hub as it is now. If they were to make that decision now, I bet they would go to Toronto if they were in the same position. City living and the fast pace of life is takes a lot out of people, and businesses are a lot of companies are now telecommuting. Mm-hmm. We are letting their employees work from home, and that is a mindset in itself. That's a skill you have to get into. You can't let your spouse give you the laundry or another list for shopping or whatever. You have to be dedicated. So what is interesting is a lot of now buildings that are in corporate Canada in Bay Street and the surrounding area are now empty and filled by maybe once or twice a week with their employees. So communications in the corporate world has changed a lot. I'm finding that a lot of business leaders don't have ideas on how to use, for instance, Skype and the current tools that are available to them, where they could reduce their costs and make their company far more efficient and productive, and their employees.
Mm-hmm. Because I think there's two aspects to the telecommuting aspect. An individual can be working in an area that is conducive to a successful productivity. Because let's be honest, you know, I think the average productivity of a corporation may be, you know, 25%. Of the week is actually productive, especially if you factor in meetings and stuff like that. But there's also the aspect of leveraging the cost as well, because when you think about it, if you're in a downtown core like a Toronto,
you have to have a seat.
You have to have that square footage.
Right.
It's not the most cost-efficient way nowadays, especially when you think about Skype as an example, where you can have, well, even or Google Hangout, where you can have a 10-person virtual presence at the cost of nothing. The cost factor of having a company, especially when you're trying to be cost-effective and competitive, it does really open it up. But most executives, most companies are struggling with that. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of people have difficulty in tuning into telecommuting, as I alluded to a minute ago. It's a discipline. You have to. It took me a long time to get used to it. Working from home by myself as an entrepreneur, it can be very lonely as well. And I'm an extrovert, so I need people around me. So that can be tough in itself. So you have to get really used to it. And I'd be interested to know whether there's any measurables on whether productivity, what the measure, the percentile of productivity is better on Bay Street, or whether it's better if you're at your home way out in the boondocks.
Because to your point, there's work that can be done individually, and then there's work that needs to be done as a team.
Collaboratively, yeah.
And the collaborative tools haven't necessarily evolved, or we haven't learned to work with those collaborative tools. I know a lot of people still print off stuff, even though we live in a paperless world.
Supposedly.
Because, you know, they want to have it in their hands.
Exactly.
You know? So the reason I bring all of this up is one of the things that you do among all your services is career transitioning and whatnot. And I do want to get to that a bit later. But part of that career transitioning quite often involves looking at alternative disciplines and alternative work styles or whatnot. Before we get to that, I want to kind of cover some of the key areas of what you do.
Okay.
Now, there's a few of them, and I'll start with the one that's the most obvious, the resume side.
Yes. Okay.
Tell me a bit about your business from the resume aspect.
Okay, so a resume is another communications tool. It's a 2 or 3 page document that really sells a person to their optimum. So, and they evolve over time. There's different styles, different formats. And there again, technology has had its impact on resumes. Now, a lot of companies in corporate Canada, across the world, they employ what's called ATS, automated tracking systems. So you can't beat a computer, but you can at least try and match it based on keywords, which is functional based, level based, and industry based. So I, as a resume writer, a leading resume writer, know all those keywords, so I can position my clients, whoever they may be, leaders of corporate Canada and America, to their optimum and get the maximum read. Mm-hmm. But they're also still traditionally read by human beings, so you have to make them look, the format has to be correct and whatever. So a resume today is a very detailed document. I don't call myself a resume writer anymore. I call myself a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell stories on behalf of my clients. We become a very performance-driven society, and all a future employer is going to recruit you for is your success stories. They're not going to hire you for your responsibilities. When I first started writing resumes many, many years ago, responsibilities were full, but everybody knows a responsibility. They want to see you success. You can drive the business. You initiate this. You create this. You extract costs. You eliminate this. You take out duplication. So they need to see how much you are a performer. And of course, a lot of it revolves around dollar values and percentiles.
Mm. And it's kind of funny because a lot of the HR documents are still written from a functional responsibilities point of view. Yet what gets submitted, as you say, is now shifting more to a performance. How do those two match up?
So that's very interesting. So there's two documents that everybody should have, really have. So a resume and a cover letter. So my philosophy on a resume is a historical document. It takes you from today backwards, documents your career history and your performance with some of your soft skills and definitely your hard skills. Those are your keywords. And then a cover letter written in the personal pronoun, the word I, my, he or she, then takes you from today forwards. And that matches you as a candidate to whatever the job you're applying for. And in that one, again, it's keyword savvy, so you should take some of the keywords out of the job description and bring them into the cover letter. Now, cover letters is very interesting. When I first started writing resumes over 20 years ago, cover letters were only read by about 19% of the decision-making population. Just recently, there's been a study. They're now read by over 90% of people. So they are very, very important document. They go in hand in hand with a resume.
Well, to your point, a lot of the computers will take care of the you know depth of reading of the resume, validate it, pass it on. The cover letter tends to still be written in that personal tone that tends to be, as you say, more readable and thus gets more read, right?
Yeah, but you should have the wow factor. You should seduce the reader, as I say, and make them want to pick up that phone and give you a call. Because a resume, cover letter, they don't get you the job, they get you the interview. Mm-hmm. And even in today's economy, when I actually see it's the best economy for senior executives in Canada for hiring I've ever seen, you're still in the competition, and you need to be number one, and then you need to be number one in the interview, which is another communication tool.
You brought up the interview, and I want to get to that in 2 seconds. The thing that comes up to me when you talk about those keywords, it's almost like reverse SEO. You know, we talk a lot about search engine optimization when we're talking about the internet. Your resume still needs to be just like SEO, keyword rich, targeted, and whatnot. But just like SEO, you can also promote, you know, to rise above. And I think that's where networking comes into play.
Oh, yes. You and I, I'm a fierce networker. Mm-hmm. I'm a furious networker, both in person and online, using the tools of LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Google+. But in person, you can't get around in person. Shaking hands, touching flesh, smiling at people, and then listening to them and giving. The network is all about giving before you actually take. Mm-hmm. And I teach networking. Very, very important. In fact, what is interesting, in Canada, only 9% of jobs are advertised. 12 are held by recruiters. So we've just topped 20%. The rest is hidden and achieved and uncovered through networking. So you have to be in my old trade, like become a detective and mm-hmm. go and find those jobs. And there are tons and tons of jobs available right now.
The thing that you brought up there I find kind of interesting. When you think about the ones that are posted, even the ones that are posted, quite often it's the networking behind the scenes. That they're posting almost because process and policies demand it.
Yeah.
But you know, that there's a lot of talk out there where a lot of the resumes that get submitted, even though it's been posted, the job really was posted just for policy. The real hiring has always been in the networking. So even that 9% is maybe a false 9% and shifting even more so to the networking.
Exactly. Well, you know, there are some of my clients who are very well educated, think that 80 to 90% of jobs are advertised and they fall into the category of Workopolis and Monster. Well, actually, if you consolidate Monster and Workopolis together, it's 3%. Mm-hmm. Very minute. The way to get your job is, even if you are applying for a job, is to try and network with the decision makers who will be your boss or your boss's boss in that company. Mm-hmm. So that's where LinkedIn is a fantastic tool for doing your research on the company, the corporate culture. Are you going to fit into that corporate culture? And what they're looking for, their service offering or their product offering, what they manufacture or whatever. And also network with the people who've left the mm-hmm. company, because they can dig up all the dirt for you. And then you've got something to talk about as a conversation point in the interview.
Mm-hmm. And to your point, there's the networking and then the interview. And the networking, very much like everything else that's social, you really shouldn't be selling at that point. The selling kind of comes on the back end. And, you know, I always say you want to get it to a point where they come to you as opposed to you going to them, because that's where there's a position of power to a certain degree.
Exactly.
The resume and the networking discover the opportunity, get you into the door. If you can make it past HR, ideally, you know, the networking kind of gives you that curve around HR.
Sure.
You're now in the actual interview process. Some of the coaching that you do to help people with the interviewing itself.
Well, I try and simplify the interview process. Everybody gets so nervous and they get head up and they freak out about it. Well, actually, really, an interview, to be honest, is a meeting of the minds. Mm-hmm. Often the interviewer, it's not at the top of their list, their job description. They don't particularly care for doing it. So I tell my clients, it's just a meeting of the minds. It's a conversation. And it's also a two-way conversation. A bad thing is to let it be a one-way conversation, let the interviewer take control. You also need to take control, and you also need to ask probing questions to show that you've actually done your research into that particular company as well. So I try and simplify it and try and eliminate all those nerves, unnecessary nerves in my point of view. We get nervous, it's just human nature. I get nervous when I public speak. And I always look for the exit just in case. But, just in case I have to run. But it's a meeting of the minds.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you brought up there was the two-way process. And I think a lot of people are either intimidated or lack the confidence to take that aggressive, I'm interviewing you. Mm-hmm. And exactly. Let's be honest. I think most of the churn that we have in organization is due to bad either hiring or people taking a job just because they needed it, because they didn't ask those probing right. questions, because either they're desperate or they're just not aggressive enough in finding it. Some of the things that come out of that probing, because I think most people can answer questions, but not a lot of people can ask questions. So what are some of the things that an interviewer should be looking at?
Well, I'm finding that a lot of interviews now are shifting towards corporate culture. Mm. So when a recruiter or an HR professional has got that job specs into them in front of them, and they put the check marks down and they're supposed to have all 10 or 15 or whatever, they don't have to have that anymore. They maybe have 14 of the 15 or 9 of the 10, and corporate culture, and they're exploring for that corporate culture. Are you able to collaboratively work as a team member, as an active, proactive, and engaging team member, and be a contributor to this company? And those other things that may be missing, the one the check mark or two check marks, you might be able to learn and embrace very, very quickly and so ramp up. But are you familiar with the corporate culture? This is becoming a huge thing in corporate North America.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your point, one of the conversations I had with someone earlier says, how can a global company do so well over here and do so poorly over here? And my answer to him was very simple. It's people. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what the policy documents are, or the process documents are, or the corporate infrastructure is. You're still taking a human being and putting him in there and expecting that human being to interact with another human being,
exactly.
Which is, right now it's two people in the room talking, and that's easy. You introduce a third person, the levels of complexity go up, threefold, I believe, then you add fourth, and it grows and grows. Oh, yeah. So when you are a multinational organization, you're talking thousands of employees and millions of connecting points. Mm. It's extremely difficult, not only as a manager or as a director or as a VP, but also as an employee, to navigate those lines of communication.
Oh,
one of the things that came up in the tour was how people didn't want to have multiple lines.
Yeah,
they wanted
exactly.
to find a way to get multiple things through one line. Hmm. It's the same thing, because the more lines you have, the more complicated it is. So when you talk corporate culture, how much of that is being able to talk within one line, if you know what I mean, as opposed to
succinctly,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's very. We have to simplify things. We got into in the 80s and 90s, and maybe the new millennium. We got into complexity. Now, it's we need to simplify things and move things along, and that's where human resources are the most expensive asset the CFO. Of a company freaks out when they add talent, but productivity needs to raise, and if you have got productivity raised and you've got high morale, and then productivity will raise, and you perhaps don't need as many people to be employed if you've got a very high morale and engaged and excited workforce.
I've always said, and this is going back to a previous life of mine. You give me 25 collaborators. Mm-hmm. And I will compete against a company of 250, 2,500 and dominate. Because sure. you could do more with 25 motivated, collaborative individuals than you can with a disconnected organization, especially one that's broken up into fiefdoms and stuff like that.
And then disparate. I mean, we were just talking a little bit about international. Having international background when you're a senior executive is very, very important these days because we've become a very, very small world. Mm-hmm. Look at some of the companies here in Canada. You know, BlackBerry are coming back, and they're a global company. I worked a lot with BlackBerry during their downsizing, and I was blown away by how many countries they had actually had physical staff in, mm-hmm. not just the products, but physical staff in. So it's very, very important that we have international business protocol, and you know how to shake hands in ABC company or XYZ country. And you know the business protocol. We become such a small world.
We talked about the resume process. We've talked about the interview process. There's another layer around that, which is the personal brand. Okay, and that kind of leads into the storytelling.
Sure. Yeah.
Your thoughts on... A lot of people don't like the word personal branding. No. I've shifted away from it myself.
Right. Yeah.
To me, it's just the new way of who we are. It's your own stories,
right,
if you will. Your thoughts on the world of personal branding as it relates to the networking, the resume writing, the interview.
Okay, so that's I'm very passionate about personal branding, and I was into personal branding before it became like the world phenomenon. It's taken over the world. Everywhere you go on the internet, there's personal branding. You've got to have this brand, you've got to have that brand. Personal brand to me, and I try and simplify it. It's your unique promise of value. What is so special about you that would separate you from everybody else? So it's simple. It's your competitive edge. It should be very succinct, very memorable, and you should also live up to your personal brand. So very, very important. So many people don't live up to their personal brand. But so it's your differentiator. When you have, I go and give seminars to the accountants, and they all think they're bean counters. They're not. Everyone in that room I go and give a seminar to has their unique promise of value. What is so special about them? So when I try and uncover that, what makes them, what type of accounting are they specialized in? And we all have this wall when we talk about accountants and other functions, but now everybody has their personal brand.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you brought up was you had to deliver on it, because it's one thing to just say, I am X.
Right.
It's another thing to say is, I can deliver on
sure.
X. And a lot of people will say, you know, the personal brand is not what you say you are, is what people say when you're not in the room.
Right.
And that, I think, is more of an indication of the reality of your delivery versus your promise.
Exactly.
Or of delivery. And I think I use the analogy of it's like sales versus marketing.
Mm.
You know, if your personal brand is just marketing and you don't actually have a conversion,
right.
you haven't delivered on your brand.
No, exactly.
If you're just converting, but you're converting on anything, then you don't have a brand, you just have sales.
Right.
So really, it's the combination, that mesh. And most organizations, you always hear that back and forth between it's sales' problem, it's marketing's problem. And that really, I think, is a testament to that world.
Exactly.
In the era that we live now, where, as you say, it's a small global world now, the internet, and like I said, we most of the internet is on telephone wires.
Exactly,
which is why one of the reasons we're here right now. We live in a world where your brand and your promise and your opportunities are greater than just the city you're in, especially when you factor in telecommuting. Hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How does that translate into the stuff that we've talked about, like networking, like communicating with people, like collaborating over the wire where you're not face-to-face? What are some of those challenges? And I'm sure HR is completely freaking out of that, because most organizations still can't deliver with three people in the room. How are they going to deliver with three people that are not in the room?
That's a very interesting question. It's very complex to have geographically disparate staff. one over here, one over there, another one in another country. And that's what makes HR life or just general leadership very, very difficult. I'm working with a chief information officer, and he was in charge of 67 different countries. And when he went to this company, he had 67, and you're a techie guy, you could understand this a lot. He had 67 different systems. So his mandate when he was engaged by this company, he's out of Atlanta, is to bring and synergize all those companies, and they all operate under totally different culture. Some of those people in Indonesia or India or other countries didn't want to listen to him. They wanted their own way. So he's got a clear understanding now on how to interact and persuade and convince and collaborate people that this is the best for them in that particular country, but it's also the best for this company as it is right now.
Another aspect of what you do is transitioning.
That's right.
Okay. And a lot of businesses have a high retainment rate where people have been stuck in the same network with the same group of people for many years, and all of a sudden they leave that world and they're lost.
Yes.
Okay. And then you've got another group of people that in the past would have been called job hoppers, but we've come to realize that some of the most successful people have a new job every 2 to 3 years, and it's that variety that makes them, the valuable talent they are. Plug. But your thoughts on the transitioning on those two aspects, both those that have never transitioned before, and they're like, they've been in the same job for 25 years, and oh, what am I going to do? And those that have transitioned a lot in light of modern changes.
That's another good question. So. We're sitting at the hub, Bell Canada, where the phone was thought out at this house here. Bell Canada have a reputation for keeping their staff for a very long time, and then they come out and they're wandering. They have no idea what they do. They're like chickens without heads. What do I do now? And they're very frightened. Being downsized today, terminated, canned, dismissed, or whatever you want to call it, isn't generally against you. It's just another business decision. They need to either march in a new direction or they need to extract costs. And of course, in the recession, there are thousands and thousands of those, not so many these days. Although in the GTA, every week, every Monday and Tuesday, 1,200 people terminated. So it's not a thing of the past. To get those people, it's the stress level is very high. There's a stress monitor. I can't remember what it is called, but it's up there with death and divorce and then downsizing. The three go almost hand in hand. So it's not against you, but there is still the anger, the rage, the why me. And I love transitioning people. I'm called the Terminator. I go and terminate very senior executives. And I tell them it's going to be okay. There's new horizons, new opportunities, especially in today's day and age where hiring is very, very robust and rampant. Transitioning them through that phase and even getting them to tell their spouse can be difficult. I haven't had any clients myself, but I know of people who've haven't, because they're mortgaged, they're leased, they're rented up to the hilt, and they haven't had the guts to go and tell their spouse, and they've just gone to pretend for the next 6 months that they're at work, and they go and sit in a Tim Hortons or somewhere for the rest of the day. That's very scary and also very sad. Mm-hmm. But to be transitioned, to be terminated, is a fact of life. It's a business decision. It's no longer an illness like it was seen many years ago. I used to stand next to people at networking events when I first started that I was scared I'd catch a disease from them. But no, they're it's a fact of life. Yeah.
The 5 years ago when I started my transition, I went through a lot of what you were talking about, and one of the biggest question marks I had was, who am I?
Exactly.
And more importantly, I think I had come to the realization that work, that job, that evolution of my career was no longer me.
Right.
Okay. But for the longest time, my job was me. Mm-hmm. And I went through all of those stages. I remember the angry period quite a lot.
Sure.
And I actually have some diaries that I wrote down at the time that if someone were to pull those up right now out of context, you'd start questioning.
Yeah.
So I understand that process. But I also know that that was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because the person that I am now was a direct result of that process.
Hmm.
And I did have the outplacement
Right.
thing, but that disappears fairly
sure.
quickly
when
you're on your own.
Yeah.
But it was that alone time. And I think there's another reason why I love this location, was that alone time spawned the telephone. Had he been surrounded by his investors, had he been surrounded by his business people, he would not have had that in-depth insight.
How true.
You know?
Yes.
So is there something to be said about that transition period where you have to experiment, you have to go out and try new things, this is your opportunity. Do you go back on the bandwagon and try to reproduce what you had, or do you use this as an opportunity to do something new? Your thoughts on that?
Well, there's many opportunities. You can just jump on the bandwagon again and try to execute a job search with a coach, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very biased, and have a dynamic resume, or...
An elite resume.
An elite resume. Yes, we must get that one in.
Get your branding right.
Yeah, exactly. You need to have... to go out on your own, you need to have a sort of you have to have a tolerance to risk, because entrepreneurs like us, we don't know when our next clients are going to come. I mean, I've got a brand out there, so I know I'm going to get clients next week, but yeah, you're just on the edge there. Canada is a very entrepreneurial society. Per capita, there's more entrepreneurs in Canada than any other Western country. So, you know, it's pretty damn good. Some succeed, some don't. And also Canada, this is very interesting. They're very adverse, it's okay to take a step out and go into an entrepreneurial business, and then that maybe failed or you don't like it for some reason, and then go back into the corporate life. It's not classed as a black mark against you like it is in some countries.
Mm.
Where you have to be either a corporate guy or you're an entrepreneur. You can't cross that path. Entrepreneur. I love being an entrepreneur. I no longer have a sergeant or an inspector to answer to. And I can work, we were talking about earlier on today, we can work our own hours. I have a global clientele, so I have to work 4 o'clock in the morning or 12 midnight with a client in Australia. Transition, coming back to transition, it's perfectly okay. And everybody has those transitional skills. And that's where you should hire a coach, whether you go through an outplacement company where you were offered with it when you were downsized, or whether you should just make the investment in yourself and go to see a coach like me, a career coach or an executive coach, and uncover those skills and then match them to a new opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking a little bit earlier on about incubators.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a very entrepreneurial society, innovative society here in Canada. I mean, BlackBerry is a classic example, one that comes to instant mind. And that's not long ago. There's Mars in Toronto. There's the York Technology Association. There's Communitech in the Kitchener-Waterloo area, which is a hub for people, inquisitive, innovative people who want to exercise their vision.
When you think of what we talked earlier about the resumes, the job interviews, a lot of that conversation at the time focused with the traditional corporate employee-employer relationship. How does some of that stuff translate to the entrepreneur? Because I'll be honest, I can't tell you the last time I've had to update my resume, because my resume is me online.
Yeah, exactly.
If you know what I mean?
Sure.
I know the answer kind of, but
right.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on what does that world look like on the entrepreneur side?
You mean as far as social media is concerned?
The entire, we talked about personal branding, we talked about networking, we talked about resumes and interviews. When you're not dealing with a corporation per se, and you're dealing entrepreneur to entrepreneur, or finding your own clients, because to me, an employer would be the corporate answer, a clientele is the entrepreneur's answer.
Sure.
Right? So how I network with a clientele, how I submit a proposal to a client versus submitting a resume.
Sure.
You follow?
Yeah, so it's your brand. You have to have that brand both online, on all the social media, the active social media ones, and the passive social media. So if somebody goes to Google you, you need to show up. That's very, very important. Even if you have a name like John Smith, you there are ways you can get up to at least maybe the second or third page. But then marketing yourself as an expert. That's another way around. Everybody has it in them to be an expert, and so I market myself as an expert in resume writing and coaching and downsizing our placement or career transition services, and everybody has it in them. So you need to build a brand, you need to build a business case to then put forward your proposals through networking. So networking, coming back to online, having quite a significant presence, blog, mm-hmm. You blog, I blog, very, very important. And then nothing surpasses the in-person networking. And I can take you just in the Greater Toronto Area, networking morning, noon and night, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
You go to meetups?
Yep.
There's tons of meetups, and they're all within a specific function. So you need to network in your own function, but you also need to network out of your own function.
Well, the nice thing too, and you brought up a very good point there, and I want to come back to that very quickly. The nice thing about meetups and stuff like that is if there's not one that exists already, you can create one. You know, yeah. And be a
leader.
You don't have to be a spoke. You can be a hub. You brought up a couple of aspects, but I'm looking at the time, so I want to make sure we cover everything. When we look at the stuff that we've covered up to date, what am I missing? What have we not talked about?
The importance of social media.
Let's dig down.
And digital dirt.
Now, I may not know anything at all about social media. That would be sarcasm.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on someone that has seen the evolution of the workplace. So there's social media in the workplace, social media outside of the workplace.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on social media?
Well, invariably it's free. You can upgrade from LinkedIn and certain other platforms. But it's a platform which can while away tons, but I think we've both been there, done that. You can while away hundreds of hours just having fun and building your brand and making yourself look good and building your image online. But you must, if you're not online today, if you're not on social media, definitely LinkedIn if you're a corporate executive, and to a degree an entrepreneur. There are other platforms more attuned for entrepreneurs, but if you're not on LinkedIn as a corporate executive, you're committing career suicide. Mm-hmm. One thing I see, and it's a cardinal sin, and I don't know why people starting to get the message. While they're in career transition, they're very furious on social media, mm-hmm. the different platforms, the active platforms, and whatever blogging may be, and then suddenly they drop off because they've landed a job, and then 3 years later they're suddenly back on LinkedIn. So what I do is I pick up the phone and say, oh, you've just recently been terminated. And they say, well, how do you know? And I've just seen you on LinkedIn for the first time in 3 years. Well, you need to manage your career. People don't manage their career. They manage their finances, and they see their financial planner every year. And entrepreneurs as well. Entrepreneurs need a coach as well, because statistics show that entrepreneurs who have coaches perform a lot better. And I have a coach. And I'm a coach, so coaches have coaches.
Psychologists have psychologists.
Exactly. So you need to manage your career, because people who don't manage their career, if they manage their career and have a career coach, statistics, there's white papers written, there's many other statistics on the internet. Coaches can elevate your productivity. They can also advance your career. Therefore, you're earning more. Your earning potential grows. And then you can give more to your financial planner at the other end of the year when you've got RRSPs and any other investments. So, people don't get that concept.
Well, you brought up a very good point, because to your point, most people only think of networking or any form of online, let's call it the resume, for lack of a better statement, when they need it. But they don't realize that it's a long tail thing. Like, I gave up, you know, part of me, the reason this is the disposable web and not the social business hangout is the social business hangout was tied to my social business mentor brand.
Right.
It was the primary means of me networking and promoting that brand. And when I decided to put that brand on hiatus or on hold or
sure.
cancel it or
yeah.
whatnot, I wanted to still do podcasting, but I couldn't call it the social business hangout. What's real about that, though, is even though I don't actively promote myself as the social business mentor anymore, there is still to this day only one social business mentor
oh, yeah.
on the internet, and that's me.
Yeah, you have
I could
plans.
Get a call tomorrow,
yeah.
a week from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, because that content is A, evergreen for the most part. It may have been too advanced for the era, so the world may catch up
sure.
to it. And all of a sudden, I may all of a sudden have to put that hat on again
mm-hmm.
because it's a long tail.
But you have a brand out there. Your brand is being built around that concept.
It is. And I
it's
think...
It's going to be difficult to shift it.
You know, it's funny because... And I'll touch on it briefly because when I decided to stop it, I had fun with it. So socialbusinessmentor.com
mm-hmm.
is me. And I decided to create a subdomain called anti.socialbusinessmentor.com.
Oh, okay.
So I'm actually having fun with the anti-social
yeah,
business
yeah,
mentor.
Sure, yeah.
It's still the same guy behind the scenes,
sure.
but I'm able to have a bit more fun with it. And
right.
In many ways, I found that I had to be so, I don't want to say stuffy. That's not
right.
the right word, because I'm not a stuffy individual.
No, sure.
But I had to be very formulated in that brand to establish the core of
yes.
it. The nice thing with the anti-social business mentor is that it's still the same insight still, but it's me with a little bit of a twist. And I'm
yeah.
actually enjoying that brand.
Right.
Not that I advertise that brand,
right.
because you know people don't necessarily get the joke.
Sure.
But it's actually truer to who I am than the true social business mentor, which was, as you say, the resume, cover letter, you know, the leading
chart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in terms of branding, it's part of me,
hmm.
but, you know, we were talking about a good friend of ours, Paul,
yeah.
and how his brand has shifted a bit because
mm-hmm.
of his interactions or whatnot. In many ways, my brand has evolved outside of what I defined it,
right.
be it the domain and all the hits, because, like I said,
right.
you do the search, thousands of hits,
sure.
which says a lot about the amount of time I put on
yeah,
the brand.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the extra aspects that tie to it that I think that really define the true brand. There's the core,
yeah.
and there's the little tentacles, if you will, or tendrils. And a lot of people, I don't think, talk about that aspect of branding. And I think it's what that is the, what the people are saying about you.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they don't come to me and say, Rob, I'm looking for a social business mentor, even though that's what the brand is. They're coming to me because they know it's me and they know what I'm about.
Hmm.
They may not necessarily quote the brand name.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Sure.
Your thoughts on that,
well,
actually?
The social media is very interesting because it lends... The difference between Facebook and LinkedIn is quite large, although I think that gap is narrowing. But, you know, on LinkedIn, I'm very, very serious, very close to my brand. But on Facebook, I promote my brand, Elite Resumes and my other companies and whatever. But I can also have a little bit of fun. I can tell an English joke.
Mm-hmm.
I can, you know, but you can't do that on LinkedIn because it's very serious. I stick to my point and I send educational messages and I connect with people I want to connect with. That's very, very important as well. I don't connect with everybody, with any or everybody. But but Facebook is you can and you've probably seen me. I have a little bit of joke once in a while, or you can download some stuff. And but this, people still get that message, you know. And people do like my English accent and my British sense of humor, which can be a bit weird sometimes mm-hmm. here in Canada. But that's just another way of me promoting my brand.
I think you brought up an aspect of that is you got to be social.
Mm.
And part of social is...
To be real.
To be real, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think some people try too hard. It's like SEO.
Yeah.
Okay, you can write the best SEO-written piece. All the keywords are there.
Yeah.
It's ranking perfectly, whatnot. But it's written for a robot. And it goes back to what we started the conversation with, is how much of the resume is written for the robots versus for the individual. And I think that's one of the main reasons why I've gotten out of that world.
Because
to me, if I never write another resume or go through that process ever again, I'll be happy.
Right.
The reason for that, it doesn't mean that I've given up.
No, sure.
It means that there's another way that is built around the real. And to me, real success comes from having that reality into it, whether or not that's corporate culture, whether or not that's working with peers that that understand each other, whether or not it's you focusing on the stuff that truly makes you you. You know, to your point, if you are defining yourself as an expert and you define your niche that is your personal brand, which is your unique value proposition, and you take all of that, but then you still take that individual and put them in a cube and expect them to be the same robotic, process-oriented, follow the factory model, it fails, and you wonder why.
Yeah, that's just that's interesting. Well, I try in my resumes, try and bring out some more of the personality, even though it may not be robot, as you say, robot-friendly. But, you know, if I was to write my own resume, I would like to say I like to inject fun and excitement in my team and build collaboration and whatever. So I try and set my clients a little bit apart from the robotic questions that we're going to answer, and I believe that there is a bit of leeway in when you go through ATS machinery to have your personality, although it is unfortunately that we do screen people out just because of technology, even though they may be 100% perfect or 110% perfect for that particular job.
I'll give you an example, and I'm probably going to get in crap for putting this on the record. I applied for a position with a ministry in the Ontario government for a job that was perfect. They were looking for a digital specialist. You know, hit all the marks, whatnot. Didn't even get a call back, didn't even get a reply email, didn't even get an interview, whatnot. Yet 2 weeks later, when I finally said, okay, you know, that move on type of thing, I get a voicemail from the Speaker of the House extolling my virtues and asking me, you know, to be part of a committee. So here I am with the highest possible recommendation within the Ontario government.
Speaker's very high,
And I can't get a job interview within the Ontario government. And that analogy to me speaks volumes about, I'll call it broken. You may not call it broken. I may not have, you know, followed the rules. But that, to me, that disconnect where within a small period of time, you've got a real human being who's interacting with you, power and whatnot, yet the HR machinery, whether or not as could not connect the two. And to me, what personal branding and all the stuff that we've talked about is what's bringing those two together. And if you don't have both, you're either writing for the robots and hoping to go with it, and what you'll find yourself, I think, is a robotic job as a result, or you're the entrepreneur and it's mostly human interaction, but the two are coming together, and I think that's where social media, and that's a very wide statement, is helping with that. Your final thoughts on that?
Well, that's very interesting again. So the advantage of living in Canada, where we have the lowest percentile of jobs advertised at 9%, as I alluded to earlier on, works to your advantage, because then you can actually go out and solicit your own job and find an appointment at an ABC company or XYZ company, and there's the networking, the in-person networking. You don't have to go via that very bland, very specific or keyword specific software. You can actually interact, whether it be initially over LinkedIn or other platforms, and hopefully on the phone and then in person with a key decision maker who can make that decision whether they want to hire you or not.
Or at least get you through the system
if
for some reason. Because we didn't talk about ATS, but prior to ATS, there was another thing that recruiters used to use, and that was the staircase. They would take their 100 resumes, throw it at the top of the staircase, and the 20 that made it down would be the one they would look at.
So it's where people see 9% as a disadvantage, but actually it can work to your advantage. By you can now interact more effectively than you could if you live in Europe, where 60 or 70% of jobs are advertised. So the chances of you networking and convincing that person when it has to go through the traditional HR route is lower. So we're very lucky here to have only 9%.
I want to do something, and I wasn't planning on this one, but you've seen me online for a while. You've met me in front. I have a brand, as you say. I'd like to hear what you think my brand is. Wow. If you were to describe me, given our interactions and what you've seen online, both the Facebook sarcastic
Yeah,
someone,
yeah, yeah.
I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah,
I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you're very true. You're very dedicated. You're very funnel to where you want to go. You send out good messages, and I can't remember exactly. I can't give you verbatim some messages. But you also, like me, go off a little bit. You like to have some humor and like to have your little bit of a perhaps this is going over the top, but a zany side. And I'd like to do that. You and I have a different audience, so I can't go too far off my brand.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're very true. You're very the word that comes through in every message that you are passionate.
Mm.
And I particularly don't like that word in a resume, but for an entrepreneur, I think it's very, very true. And you have to have that passion as an entrepreneur, otherwise you will fail.
Mm-hmm. And I think you said something there, and I'll interject. That passion, I think, was an Achilles heel in the corporate world, but is a lightning rod in the entrepreneur world.
Yeah.
And I think it's taken me a very long time, sadly, to redirect that passion towards an audience that respects it, for lack of better
term. Passion doesn't fit in the corporate world. I mean, one of the new questions, this is very interesting, one of the new questions that's asked in an interview is, what one word, just one word, would describe you? Passionate, you're going to kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Driven, you're going to kill yourself. You need to think of an unusual word, the word that would stand out, a word that would resonate with the audience, like efficacious or audacious. The one word I really like of one of my clients, her one word was, she's now CEO of a big hospital complex, a healthcare corporation. Her one word was brilliance.
Mm.
So not only is she brilliant, but she radiates the brilliance of a diamond. And she could defend that. Obviously, you don't say a word and then you can't defend it.
Mm.
You have to defend it both in the resume and orally when you get to the interview stage.
So once again, the thesaurus is your friend.
Oh, the thesaurus is amazing. Yeah, I mean, I tell clients, they come up with these wussy words, and I say, just go to the thesaurus online. There's so many other options there. Yeah.
The English language, or any language, is considerably more vast than the limited vocabulary.
Yeah.
That
Oh, exactly. I mean, I'm lucky. I think I have a fair take on the English language. The Queen's English.
The Queen's English.
I have to get that one right.
Yes.
There are so many other words for one word.
Reintroduce yourself.
My name is Martin Buckland. I have a company called Elite Resumes. So I hold multiple certifications in career transition, several in resume writing, and many in coaching. So I'm an executive coach, I'm a career coach, I'm a job search coach, a personal brand coach, and many others. And I help people reach their career dreams.
And I think the one word that I would use, you are indeed a coach.
Thank you very much.